Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
So here's a fun conversation I had with my buddy Jim Papp. He is the former chief of staff for Congressman Thomas Massey in Kentucky. As fortunes would have it, we both now live in Colorado. He lives up in Woodland Park. I live in Colorado Springs. We're about 35 minutes from each other. And I went up to his storefront and sat down and did my first remote podcast. We talked about the upcoming election, which is today, and a number of other things that I think are super important with regards to current state of politics in America. Jim's not just the former chief of staff of Thomas Massey, but he's an extremely well-connected guy politically. He works with politicians, Republicans specifically, and libertarian-leaning Republicans across the country. And he's a brilliant guy and very smart and very, very fun to hang around with. And so I had a really great time with this conversation. So we'll dive right into that coming up in just a second. First of all, I want to thank our sponsors. Really appreciate Louisville Cabinets and Countertops. The folks over there do such a great job. They did a great job on my kitchen. And I'm confident that when we sold our house in Kentucky and moved, we sold it in one day, like 8 hours. And I'm confident that a big part of that was the fact that they did our kitchen and our kitchen looked so awesome. And I really trust these guys. Louisville Cabinets and Countertops. If you're a do-it-yourselfer and you want to do the project yourself, they've got cabinets in stock, which you can just go pick up. And they're affordable and they're high quality. So why not support a local business and get what you want done at the same time? So if you're a do-it-yourselfer or a contractor, check them out. Now, if you want a turnkey kitchen remodel experience, where you want to blow out a wall, you want to redo the whole way it's laid out, then they're your people as well. They've got three designers on staff, and you're really going to enjoy talking to them. So give them a call. They're at 502-930-3304, or just stop by the showroom at 6200 Hit Lane in Louisville, right on the border of Louisville and Oldham County. If you're in southern Indiana, Louisville, or Oldham County, these are you guys. To get this job done for you. So check them out. All right, let's dive into our conversation with the great and awesome and funny guy, Jim Papp.
You good now?
Yeah.
Was it flashing on you?
No. So, all right, it's new equipment, people. And I forgot, I've used this a million times in radio, but I forgot you have to hit record twice. The first time you just get a pause. So anyway, here with Jim Papp. He's the former chief of staff for Thomas Massey. This is the third time we've started the podcast. I told you it's the inaugural remote. We're in Woodland Park, Colorado at your Fit Nutrition Depot. I love this. We're actually sitting in your actual storefront here. Yeah. And we've been talking a little bit about politics. I want to dive into some of what we were talking about before we hit record.
Yeah.
But first, before we do, let's talk about the lay of the land right now politically.
Okay.
I talked to a pastor last week who actually thinks this is the end times. And I kind of agree with him because I see certain fissures in American society that are, at least on the surface, they look irreparable.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
Yes and no.
Okay.
So, and I've been working politics for 30 years, and really 30 plus years when you take the time I was in college.
Yeah.
I became a Christian in 1981. I was 16 years old. So I've been, thinking through this stuff, and all this eschatological stuff that gets thrown out there. It's always the end times, And I think it's important to check that out from a biblical perspective. So that, a pastor expressing that concern is not invalid. Mm-hmm. A lot of people will consider that sort of stuff conspiracy theory. I think any Christian and any good-minded person should be asking those questions. I mean, government inherently leads to evil.
Right.
The Founding Fathers knew this.
You read
the Federalist Papers. James Madison said, talked about we aren't governed by angels, so therefore we have to have governments, and it's kind of a necessary evil. So we should always be fighting that. But so to answer your question about right now, I think that there are valid concerns about the irreparable harm that has been done through 237 years of American government. Mm-hmm. And we were talking before we could get it actually recorded about the change that I feel like the seeds of this warfare where you set up different groups against themselves, which is really a false, these are false dichotomies, trichotomies, however sure. you want to break it sure. out. They don't really exist. They're just played upon.
Right.
And that happened with Roosevelt in progressivism. He set up the class warfare. I mean, it had kind of been lingering a little bit, but he really institutionalized it in the trust busting and some of this stuff. Some of which might have been important issues to ask, but Standard Oil was going to break apart.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was just naturally going to do it. That's natural monopolies fall apart over generations. But anyway, he set up this class warfare. Wilson continued it. FDR institutionalized it by setting up problems that didn't really exist.
Green New Deal.
Yeah. His actual New Deal in that case. He'd set up these problems, and then he'd provide the government solution.
Right.
Democrats have been doing that ever since. Republicans do it to a certain degree
sure.
as well, too.
Yeah. They set up wars.
Right, exactly.
That we have to fight.
The military-industrial complex.
Right.
I mean, I think Dwight Eisenhower was prophetic and,
yeah.
and discerning.
That speech is amazing. If anybody's not, if you're listening to this, go look up Dwight Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech. It's powerful.
And like you and I agree, we need a badass military.
Oh, yeah.
So there, no doubt about that. And that is a constitutional effort.
Sure.
What's not constitutional is running around in wars for no good reason.
Right.
Like
right.
World War I.
Right.
There was absolutely no reason for us to be in World War
I. Who the hell is Archduke Ferdinand?
That's right. And it was a localized
problem. Yeah, it was a local political issue.
And now, World War II is a different issue.
Sure.
We did need to get into that. There were real threats. I get that. And there are some people that believe like us who say, no, World War II is bad. No, I think that was fine. But just running around in wars is not good. But anyway, so we have the Democrat Party has institutionalized this problem. So irreparable damage that exists right now. Right now, if you are a Thomas Massie going into Congress, you literally have the entire city against you. If you're Donald Trump, you have the same thing.
Yeah.
So this really showed itself in this whole CARES Act fight that happened early in 2020, where Thomas was saying, listen, the Constitution says you have to have a quorum to do business.
Right.
I mean, it's not even
and subject
to
for people to that are listening, the CARES Act was the initial stimulus package that was passed to help with COVID.
Yes.
So I say with air quotes.
Yeah, exactly. More than $2.4 trillion, I think it was, that they were going to voice vote on the floor of Congress, and everybody was gone.
Right.
And Thomas said, whoa, hold on a minute. You know, and by the way, he followed the rules. He could call for a quorum. Any member of Congress can do that. What typically happens, and it's usually on naming post offices or something innocuous, sometimes big, by the way. This isn't the first time it's happened. But anyway, he was going to call for a vote. Everybody was upset with him. Republicans hated him. I mean, even some of our good Republican friends, I won't name them, that were like, what are you doing? Democrats were against him. The media was against him. Even the president was calling Thomas out on
He talked about the – because the president tweeted about him. And then he talked about the phone call he got from the president.
He and I had that discussion privately.
And I was like, I wonder, I mean, can you imagine the kind of pressure that you would feel when the president of the United States, whoever he is, is on the phone? Of course, I had Barack Obama hang up on me, but he wasn't president yet. He was about to be. But I still, I kind of relished that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when you are in the crosshairs of the most powerful person in the world.
Right.
And everybody in the world agrees with him.
Right.
about you being in his crosshairs. That's a powerful stand of principle.
He literally, Thomas did, had everyone against him. I told him on the phone, we had a I didn't call him when it was happening because I'm like, okay, first of all, I know Thomas, you know, he's just focused on this. But secondly, there was no reason for me to just add to everything.
Right.
But we talked a few weeks after that, and I told him this. I said, you know, there are a lot of people who could have had some courage to do what you did. But I said, I think it took an engineer in this case. Because for an engineer, when they see how the machine works,
right.
it, whatever their emotions are, whatever they think about it, it's impossible for them to think outside of how the machine's put together. If it works, it works. If it is what it is, you got to work with that. There's no way to get around that.
Right.
And Thomas, you know, you read the Constitution, it says you must have a quorum to do business.
Right.
I'm sure you had the same emotions that anyone else would have in this. But being an engineer, it was impossible to break away from it. He agreed with that. And that's one of the cool things about a guy like him. You know, he's already got the principles down.
Right.
There are other engineers who wouldn't do it, but it's the nature of an engineer.
Yeah.
And so it took it in this case. And to be candid, so I had, when I talked to him about this, I had just received a call from Steve Scalise. He's the Republican whip. His floor director calls me because he thinks I'm still Thomas's chief at the time. And he says, in the midst of the conversation, he says, I think we all agree your boss was right. And I told Thomas that and it generated the conversation. But so you need this kind of courage to make these changes. And Thomas is not an outcast right now.
Right.
Because he took the stand, everything against him, and didn't back down, and it worked. You can't argue against the Constitution if it's
right.
proposed, you can discard it. And that's where, so this gets to your question in a roundabout way. That's where the fundamental problem is right now. We don't regard the Constitution, and we don't have enough people who, like Thomas, are willing to stand up for it at the risk of losing their ability to do so. Thomas was in a primary. Yeah. It seemed like it was a competitive primary. But it became an entirely uncompetitive primary because he stood for principle and people responded to that. We don't have enough of that right now. And that's why the momentum may not change in this country.
Yeah. What worries me, Dan Crenshaw was our guest recently on the podcast, and his book, Fortitude, I think is the name of it. And I've kind of had this little bug in my side or burr in my saddle for a while that I made this statement. And it was a little controversial on social media, but I stand by it. And I said, the current generation of young people will accomplish very little of note to contribute to human society. And I said, the reason is not because this current generation has a lack of brilliant minds. It's because this generation is in the thought prison of cancel culture and outrage society. And the question that I asked Dan was, how do you raise resilient, free-thinking children who respect individualism, freedom, meritocracy, the Constitution, in a society that attempts to deplatform anyone who believes that? And it's fascinating to me that thinking, that deplatform thinking, that cancel culture thinking is not the majority of Americans, but it operates as if it is, and we allow it. And that's what terrifies me for this election and for what comes next after this election.
You know, I always say, there are a couple things I always say. Success, I think we might have said it in the recording, so I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but 6,000 years of recorded human history proves the moral depravity of man.
Right.
I also say that this politics thing would be easy if I didn't have to deal with people.
Right.
So what we're struggling against is the human condition, mm-hmm. human nature. We're not struggling against principles. We're struggling against the willingness of a society to assert certain principles. Mm-hmm. This is why if any objective observer sees the founding fathers as brilliant, almost divinely inspired men and women, by the way, we forget the women that were involved then, certainly. We were a different culture in that regard, but women were part of this as well too. The way that they thought, they were thinking big. The ideals were big. Now, you can just being a big ideal is not important. But the big ideals that mattered, they were ensconced and imbued with the concepts of natural law that began with Thomas Aquinas. And then led through people like Montesquieu and Locke and some others. They understood this concept of the and by the way, for those who know philosophy, I understand we're talking about different philosophical foundations between Montesquieu and Locke and Thomas Aquinas. I get that. But this concept of the natural law, that there was a law of nature, not just in terms of specific laws you put on the books, but the things that were the fundamental principles of life, all of these men knew in their various ways that that came from God, that it was fundamental and immutable, and that it was man's requirement, if he wanted any success in this life, to figure out what that was, which essentially is thinking the mind of God. In a legal sense, the natural law is thinking God's thoughts after him, just like Kepler, Johannes Kepler, the great physicist and astrophysicist, said he also was thinking God's thoughts after him. That desire to get to that big ideal founded on fundamental reality and truth that is objective and immutable, that leads to good things. Now, what you're saying about young people in this society is the reality that they aren't connected to that way of thinking.
Right.
They don't even see that as a necessary pursuit of man right now.
Right.
And like you say, there are plenty of very intelligent, smart, capable people in these in younger generations, but they don't have this passion to look for something outside themselves to find truth.
Right.
And we have a solid constitution, which is not perfect. We all know that, but it is as perfect as you're going to get in terms of individual freedom in this life.
And, yeah.
And they were willing, they could only do that by undertaking that pursuit.
Yeah. I just read an article, it was medium.com, I think it was. It was promoted on LinkedIn, and it was about how COVID should make us rethink ambition, and that we should put our efforts more towards the collective good than our own self-interest. It's a terrifying prospect when you start thinking about that. And then you realize some of the stuff that you were talking about there. The idea you were talking about, the Enlightenment, the philosophers, that's the Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in colleges and universities, the Enlightenment is being taught as a racist entity.
Yeah.
That meritocracy is racist. That logic is racist. That details, facts, schedules is all the construct of European colonialism. That's what kids are being taught right now.
It is.
And if they veer from that, if they challenge that, if they argue with that, if they debate that, they're being canceled. And so it's a minority of people, but they occupy ground. You know, when you talk about a battle, it's like, you know, if I'm occupying the right spot, it can be very difficult to dislodge me and to kill my influence. And so you have these people that I think it's brilliant since the 1960s and 70s, the Weather Underground, the movement back then that was sort of, I guess, disguised as flower children, are now the academics of today that are advancing those goals. And it's like, it's very difficult to dislodge that influence. Not that we shouldn't entertain having a discussion about leftist point of views, but rather this influence is so pervasive that it's causing a majority of people who are center right to literally act as though we are a center left nation, if not worse, actually more like a left nation.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I mean, it's to me, that's a terrifying prospect, because when you go back to what you were saying earlier about something that's higher than ourselves or outside of ourselves, in other words, government is there to safeguard those liberties and those rights. It's not there to dole them out.
Right.
And we are seeing a massive shift right now, especially with this whole push towards like eliminating the Electoral College, packing the Supreme Court, you know, adding Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico as states. This is all bent towards power, towards creating a more quote-unquote democracy, pure democracy society, which at that point, you're now at the place where 51% get to tell the 49% what to do. And that ends this entire experiment at that point.
Well, and the founding fathers knew inherently how destructive where we are right now could become.
Right.
Because they rejected the idea of democracy.
Right.
They saw in history what happened in ancient Greece.
Right.
And some other societies, that being the far by far the most prominent one, where real democracy was there, where raw power ended up deciding what would be happening in a society. And Greece fell apart under the weight of the power struggle. So this is, I appeal to Thomas Aquinas in when it comes to the natural law, as opposed to, at least at this stage in my life, in as opposed to Enlightenment thinkers like Montesquieu and Locke and others, because he wasn't a his philosophical underpinnings didn't come from the concepts of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment actually started leading us a little bit away from God in the sense that pure reason,
yeah,
would should dictate.
Most of the founding fathers were deists, not necessarily Bible thumping Christians.
Although there were guys like Witherspoon and others,
sure,
who were not fundamentally in deism, but at least deism still saw God as his ways as a force. Now Aquinas and Augustine before him come from a much different way of thinking in that regard. They actually saw God as the supreme ruler of the universe. So, without getting too deep in the philosophical aspects of this, but that's fundamentally important because foundational principles are necessary. We came in this country to the ideal of a Republican form of government, which is representative.
Right.
Because of the failings of previous societies. And so that we got to get back to this foundation where we understand that we are flawed. 6,000 years of human nature proves the moral depravity of man. Of written human history proves the moral depravity of man. We got to understand the depraved nature of man. We're all weak. By the way, Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, whatever, wherever you want to put someone. If we don't understand our flaws, then we don't cannot protect against where those flaws would go, which is a raw power sort of politics. This is why representative government's important and limited representative government is so important. I think one of our irredeemable flaws, potentially irredeemable flaws in this country, is that government is so important in our lives. It touches so many areas of our lives. This was the genius of the Constitution. It pulled government away and allowed people to make their mistakes, failures, or successes real in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we've taken that away. Now the government determines so much for
us. Well, and Massey, not to harp on him, but Congressman Massey identifies one of the key sources of that. And again, it goes back to what I was saying about people in positions of influence. We are not run by Congress. We are run by bureaucracies.
Right.
Our whether or not you can keep this business open right here.
Right.
That we're sitting in. Whether or not, you know, whether or not I can license my car.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not I can, my wife and I are refinancing a house right now. The vast majority of the garbledygook we're going to have to do on Friday when we close that loan is literally going to be stuff that was dictated by some bureaucracy somewhere.
Exactly right.
And it's going to take us an hour and a half of our day just to go through and say, yeah, we want to do whatever this says we want to do.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like so much of our lives are run by bureaucrats. And most people, what's sad about it is it's a beautiful stealth way of almost autocracy because most people aren't even aware of it.
Yeah.
Until you actually try to make your own destiny. In other words, if you don't want to work in a cubicle and you want to start a business or build an empire or whatever, you don't notice it until you start doing something like that.
Yeah, and it's kind of the frog in the boiling pot of water thing. You know, you can't throw a frog into a boiling pot of water. They'll jump out. They'll get a little singed, but they'll push right out with their webbed feet because it's too hot, whereas you just when you slowly turn it up. We've done this by accident in some ways.
Yeah.
And so not that mortgages, for example, your analogy for yourself, not that mortgages will always be limited amount of paperwork, but the paperwork should be limited to the legal matters that need to be adjudicated between the two parties.
Right.
And not between what the government thinks the two parties ought to be doing.
Right.
Or how they're quote unquote going to protect them. So the only way to extract that, I think, in a culture, because we are dead. And we will move towards socialism unless, in my opinion, we have something like a third great awakening, which won't make everyone in the country a Christian, but it would be a cultural reset. And, of course, I would like, personally, for people to be Christian.
So you think that it – I think this is an interesting line of conversation. You think that it ties back to revival in a sense?
I,
that if we don't have an awakening of a recognition of a creator –
Yeah.
we will not save this country.
Well, let me put it to you this way.
Because if that's the statement you're making, I agree with it wholeheartedly.
Yeah, but let me put it to you in this way. There is no anchor to principles outside of ourselves unless there is some form of obeisance to the sovereignty of a creator.
Right.
So if mankind is left to his own devices, power politics will rule.
Yeah.
And that literally is what existed in this world prior to Christ.
Right.
It was taken away somewhat in certain areas, say, you know, actually Greek democracy did free mankind, at least for a short period of time, mm-hmm. under some principles that were very real. I also point all the way back to the period of Judges in the Bible. I mean, it wasn't a theocracy mm-hmm. because the laws weren't imposed through government edicts, even though God commanded of ancient Israel at that time to follow his law. They weren't done through a government system, but they were adjudicated in courts, many courts.
Didn't they have that part of that society, that Israelite society in that period, didn't it have a very advanced form of capitalism?
Oh, yeah.
Property ownership.
Right.
The exchange of goods, currency. And it was, I wouldn't call it self-government, but in a way it kind of was, right? I mean,
I would say it was.
It was maybe just administered slightly different than what would arise out of the idea of a republic, but essentially
right.
the system of government was the same. And then when problems arose between individuals or groups of individuals, they were then adjudicated in those courts. It wasn't like some pontiff sat high up on a throne and made a decision all
right.
the time. It was, you know, they came together and said, here's my problem with Jim.
Yeah.
And I think he's doing me wrong. And then the judges would determine, based on the facts, whether or not that was the case.
Yeah.
Wasn't it a fairly advanced system of capitalism?
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
yeah.
Listen, there's a farce out there that says that Jesus
was a socialist. No.
On my Against Nice podcast, I had Larry Reed on one time, Lawrence W. Reed. He ran the Foundation for Economic Education
yep.
for a while. He's emeritus president now. But he wrote a book called Was Jesus a Socialist? And the answer is clearly no.
Right.
So back then, referring to that system that existed in ancient Israel, property rights were fundamentally assured.
Right. You could get the death penalty for stealing somebody's livestock.
Absolutely.
It was property was held that sacrosanct.
Yep. For all the difficult edicts within the law of God laid out in Numbers and Deuteronomy, and particularly in Deuteronomy.
Right.
There are some things there that people
even scripture at. Though didn't scripture talk about very serious terms that if you kill a man's ox,
yeah,
you know, I mean, it's like
it wasn't the death penalty, but it was a severe penalty.
It was
penalty.
Very serious penalty.
Yeah.
I think you had to give him like twice as many
right.
or some number. It was like it was establishing that idea that this is property and you're taking away an individual's ability to achieve their livelihood.
Well, and in fact, there's a to that point. There's a verse in Proverbs that says, and I'm not saying it literally here because I can't remember off the top of my head, but it says the ox is really, really dirty and messy, but much good in terms of wealth, you
right.
know, comes from the work
it.
Of the ox.
Right.
Capitalism is a dirty business.
Yeah.
It honestly is.
Right.
But it's also the only way to fairly allow a person to reap the benefits of the hard work that they do.
Yeah.
There's no other way to do that.
Right.
In all of human history, it's never happened. Socialism and communism attempts to enforce that equity, but it always takes away rights to get that done.
It
whereas
can only...
capitalism allows that equitability to be determined by the choices you make.
Right. Here's the bottom line, the difference.
Yeah.
And I would say this to any liberal to their face. Socialism, Marxism, communism dehumanizes people.
Right.
Capitalism humanizes them.
That's right.
And I know that sounds counterintuitive to young minds who've been steeped in this bullcrap that they're being taught, but the truth of the matter is capitalism humanizes me because the only one setting a limit on what I can do with my life is me, mm-hmm. right? That doesn't mean there aren't obstacles. That doesn't mean there aren't specific challenges. That doesn't even mean that we've brought ourselves to the end of some groups in our society, some having some additional challenges that we should address through conversations that bring us to the purity of this idea of the sacrosanct of the individual. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, I was just taking a corporate training today, actually, mm-hmm. and one of the things they were talking about was, it was pretty good stuff, actually. It was talking about how you're trying to get somebody, you're trying to achieve a goal, right? And you have an individual that is perhaps being an obstacle. When you humanize them, you get farther with them. And there was a story about a guy who was the lead SWAT guy in Kansas City. And he had a reputation for being hardcore. There were lots of complaints against him by people in the city when things would go on or against his department. And they took this training, and this guy, they go into a situation where they were doing like a raid. And there was a gentleman in there. Pardon me if I tell the story, but I think it's interesting. There's a gentleman in there that they had arrested, and they were trying to get everybody that they had arrested, these members of this drug gang, to sit on the couch. And this one gentleman, they said, sit on the couch. And he said, I'm not going to sit on the couch. And this guy remembers his training, and he said his normal reaction is push him down, right? He even felt his arm going up. And then he goes, wait a minute, let's try this. Let's just see if this is BS or not, right? So the first thing he says is, I need you to sit down, because XYZ. And the guy's like, that's nice, but I'm not going to sit down. So then he's like going back to his training. He's like, all right, I've explained it. Now what's the other thing? Oh, he asks him, why won't you sit down? And the guy said, 2 weeks ago I got shot. I got surgery. I've got pins in my knee. The doctor said if I bend my knee, the pins will pop out and I have to have two more surgeries. I'm not sitting on that couch for anybody. Suddenly this guy has an epiphany, the police guy, and he says, if I bring this stool over here and we help you sit down with your legs straight, will you sit down? And he goes, yeah. So the point was, he humanized him.
Yeah.
Instead of just pushing him down and demoralizing him and demeaning him, even in that situation where he was clearly a criminal, humanized him.
Yeah.
And so it ties into this whole conversation about, like, capitalism humanizes people by letting them choose. Socialism dehumanizes them by pushing them on the couch so that we're all collectively sitting here for our own good.
You know, just to kind of stay with your analogy for a moment, this is why we watch all these videos. And you and I, we believe in criminal justice reform.
Sure.
I mean, there's
absolutely.
There's such a need to change this. But think about this. The police, there's a point at which, you know, you read Romans, staying with Christian analogy, you read Romans 13, and Paul telling Christians to respect the authority of government.
So right.
Listen, they don't carry the sword in vain.
Right.
You know, if you are really causing problems, the sword needs to come. And there is a role for government.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is we've got, I think the racism in police right now is limited to about maybe 1-3%.
If
where you
that.
Got a real, yeah, right. Where you got a real problem there.
Right.
But where the problem is in our police forces is this belief that the use of power is inherently theirs to give.
Right.
Now, in a sense it is, but it's not the only answer. And that is a beautiful story.
Right.
Because we see these videos where police are just strong-arming people, and it causes more problems
right.
than it creates. Right. I got a problem with that there is the chance that there's ever a right for a policeman to shoot anyone in the back, I think, is severely limited and maybe zero.
There's only one case I've ever seen where I felt like the police might have been justified to shoot a guy in the back, and it was because he was shooting under his arm back at
right,
them.
Right, exactly.
But that's a rarity.
And in fairness to police, in that those sorts of situations, sometimes you don't see the gun.
Right.
And you should have been able to do it.
And also in fairness to the police, they don't often shoot people in the back. Right. It's not like it happens every day.
And I'm not with, not right. with BLM. I don't hate police.
Right.
But I don't like how we do policing in this country.
No, I agree. Yeah.
So
there's
so
a legitimate conversation there around training and rethinking like that SWAT guy did.
Yeah.
That SWAT guy changed the dynamics of that entire situation.
Yeah.
They probably got more information. They got more evidence. They would have gotten and zero complaint, zero lawsuit. Because if he had pushed that guy down, that guy would have sued him for the next two surgeries.
But let's just talk about something even more importantly there, because this gets to the humanization of freedom and capital. By the way, capitalism is freedom.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's not just about the exchange of economic. It's not just about economic exchanges, monetary or otherwise.
Right.
It's about freedom. So the other thing about that, let's just say that that guy obviously committed a crime. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that situation was, but he obviously committed a crime. It's still incumbent upon the police to treat him as a human being.
Yeah.
Because anyone that commits a crime, there should be some punishment. Ultimately, there's going to be punishment before God for any crimes. But in this life, there should be punishments for crimes that harm others.
Yep. Yep.
Okay? So, but that doesn't make them not human beings.
Right.
And so we need to have that attitude. But just in our marriages, you know, there are times that my wife has an opinion, and I think it's maybe initially the stupidest thing I ever heard. But you know what? If I spend a moment and just ask some questions, I might find out that she had some wisdom that I just wasn't accessing at the time.
Yeah.
And it saves me. You know, we were just talking about just a moment ago, you know, I'm looking for something here in the store just before we started recording.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my gosh, where is this
and
thing?
And she goes right
she
to it.
She comes right to it because she had a better insight than I did at the time. There's so much of that in human interaction.
Yeah.
So getting to capitalism. Capitalism makes that a possibility.
Yes.
So there is a
and not to be confused with cronyism.
No.
Because that's what the left is doing to destroy capitalism, is trying to lump it in with cronyism, which is an entirely different thing altogether.
No, absolutely.
And that's enabled by those bureaucracies that we talked about.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you. I just want to make that clarification.
I think that's quite useful on your part to say. So on a previous podcast, I probably on the podcast we did on my Against
right.
Nice
yeah.
podcast,
yeah.
I think I talked about this. So, you know, greed. Like, what does the greediest bastard in the world have to do to become a billionaire if he wants to be a billionaire?
Right.
He basically has to follow the golden rule. It means finding a product that people want, making
Jeff
sure
Bezos.
That product is improved upon or expanded to new products based upon your finding out from your customers.
Right.
Treating employees well so that they can treat people that buy your product or service well. And you may even remain greedy and selfish.
Right.
And you still have to go through that process to be successful. And, of course, it's not the perfect thing. Capitalism is not perfect.
Right.
Because greedy people can do bad things. They can attempt cronyist things. But the reality is, the beauty of capitalism is that it's the best structure we've found to date that allows every person who really has the thought and benefit of others in mind the best opportunity to succeed, while at the same time having greedy people that do stupid things maybe have some of their success as well. But the only way for good to be given to society is in economic terms is through capitalism.
Yeah.
And this is why it's such an important thing. Now, this is why I also believe that if we had something like a third great awakening, which I want as a Christian, I want to happen because I'd like people, you know, to have a relationship with God.
Right.
But in that process, in our past history, when that has happened, it's been a cultural reset. People start thinking differently about other people.
Right.
The goodness of our country certainly had its roots in the Judeo-Christian ethic. And by the way, Andrew Breitbart was a friend of mine. And when we had talked about this, and he was an agnostic at the time. I think he became a Christian towards the end of his life. But he also would say to me when we would have some discussions like this, the Judeo-Christian ethic, without it, we have no freedom.
Right.
Because that desire to do good for others. One of the most important videos that I've ever seen is part of a conversation that Milton Friedman had with Phil Donahue. They actually were friends.
I've seen this. Yeah.
And but Phil Donahue, he's still alive, I think. He was a socialist, you know.
Yeah.
He was not a very leftist Democrat activist, so. But he really admired Milton Friedman because Milton Friedman did these things that we're talking about, thinking of others, being humanizing other people even when he disagreed with them.
Right.
But one of the things, this video was so important because Phil Donahue set up the question by saying, you know, when you think about all the inequalities in the world and the extreme poverty and all this kind of stuff, I mean, did you ever have a second thought about capitalism and greed as a motivation? Because everyone thinks capitalism is all about greed. It's not.
Right.
But it was brilliant, his response. He stated, he says, well, so who's greedy? He says, you know, we all think the other guy's greedy, not me, you know.
Right.
But he says, you know, are you saying that governments aren't based on greed?
Right.
Is political self-interest somehow more noble than personal self-interest?
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, humanizing someone comes to their political self-interest or right. their individual self-interest being able to be pursued. For some people, that would be done in an evil right. manner or ways we don't like. But what about the person that's trying to do it for good?
Yeah.
That person is shut out in socialism, communism, yep. and any other form of economic system.
Yeah, and you were saying earlier, you were talking about how capitalism is imperfect and greedy people can still do greedy things. But here's the thing. If you have more money than me, you can potentially corner the market and do something greedy, and yes, right. that could potentially harm me to a certain extent. You could hire, if you got more money than me, you could get a bigger billboard. You could put signs out in front of my business that say that my hamburgers suck. Fine. Okay. I can go sell hot dogs. Whatever. But if the government decides it's going to get greedy,
right.
the things it can do to me go far beyond what you can do to me with more money.
That's right.
And, you know, so my point being, capitalism doesn't mean all the roadblocks are going to be removed. It means there will always be an exit door. There will always be another choice. There will always be a different direction. Does it suck if you get crowded out of the market because somebody else was smarter than you, faster than you, wealthier than you? Yeah, it sucks. Does it suck if you come from a poor background and you don't have as much money and you didn't get an inheritance and all that stuff? Yeah, it sucks. Okay, I had to pay my own way through college. It sucked. My wife and I are probably 10 years behind what other people would be financially in our same situation because we didn't have anybody to help us along the way. Fine, but there's always another choice. You can always make a decision to educate yourself further, to find another vocation that pays more, to find these outlets of creativity, right? You know, you don't have to just do the one thing. And so, but in socialism, you got to do the one thing. You're a factory worker. Work in the factory. You know what I mean? And it's like, that's what really disturbs me about this whole discussion about greed and capitalism is like, I keep coming back to it, and I don't mean to be repetitive, but the bottom line is greed is not associated with capitalism or socialism. It's associated with humanity. It's yeah. just going to express itself in different ways in these different systems. And within the socialist system, the way it expresses itself is horrifying, dangerous, dehumanizing, and painful, and frankly, deadly.
One of the brilliant aspects of Milton Friedman's response to Phil Donahue in that video is that he points out a fundamental reality. Everybody is subject to greed,
right?
Or avarice,
yeah.
or covetousness.
Right.
The Ten Commandments. I mean, every human being has violated all those laws.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's express it in these terms, what you were just saying. So consider this for a minute. Inequities and injustices are going to happen in this world. There's just no way to yep. escape it.
Yep.
The question is the process through which those inequities and injustices are going to be adjudicated. And when governments set up laws to prevent injustice, because that's really what socialism and communism is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a means to prevent injustice. Well, it can't be done. All you're doing is you're transferring what they think they're doing is stopping injustice.
Right,
what they're
right.
really doing is transferring
the injustice
the doling
to,
out
to the government.
Of injustice through the government.
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I guess somehow it's going to be more benevolent if it yeah. comes from an all-powerful
we're
state.
We're going to screw you. We're just going to yeah. do it better than yeah. them greedy capitalists.
You can run from Bob in the dark alleyway. You can't run from the government no. when they show up in their armored vehicles.
Because government is power.
Yeah. yeah.
I mean, that is what it is. So the question is, how do we and the Constitution did this very well. And by the way, all our state constitutions did. We just ignore them all.
Yeah.
So, but if we followed our Constitution and our state constitutions, by and large, the way they're set up right now. There have been some changes, and maybe some of them aren't quite just some of the minor changes. But by and large, if you follow our state and federal constitutions the way they were intended, then people are free to succeed and to deal with the injustices that come
right.
through their own ingenuity, rather yeah. than having some government bureaucrat somewhere decide whether you have been treated justly yeah. or not.
I remember in college, so I'm a missionary kid. My dad had the means to make a lot of money. He was a very talented builder, but he put it all into his ministry, so I had nothing. And I went to a very expensive private Christian college, and I remember a lot of the kids there when I was a freshman, you know, they had mom and dad's old BMW.
Yeah.
They had mom and dad's, you know, we're talking really nice cars.
Right.
And I remember telling my dad, I was like, what about a car? And he just looked at me and said, what about it? And so I was driven my freshman year to be autonomous, to be free, to yeah. be able to ask a girl on a date and actually take her out instead of having to ride with a friend, you know.
Right.
I wanted that sense of autonomy. And so the first thing I did was take a job at 4:30 in the morning cleaning the meat room at Fitch's IGA until I earned enough money to buy a car that barely got me around, but it got me around, you know. And it was like, you could say that compared to the other students, I had obstacles in my path. My parents didn't pay for that college. I had to work to pay it off. I had to work extra hard to get a car. But what was interesting was once I got that car, I quit the meat room and went to work for Domino's. And now I'm making $15 an hour mm-hmm. driving a car as a freshman.
Plus tips.
So suddenly I've got the money to take a date on Friday night and to pay my tuition, whatever's left over after the loans. You know, everything changed at that moment. So you can say he had a lot of obstacles, or you can say that made me better. Right? It made me work hard. I needed something to drive towards. All my friends that had dad's old BMW didn't even appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even appreciate it. And I would be like, man, do you know what it'd be like if I could drive one of those versus my 1983 Dodge Charger that idled at 3,500 RPMs?
Right.
You know? But I wouldn't change that section of my life for anything in the world. As hard as it was, as hard as I had to grind to get what I wanted, I wouldn't change anything in the world. I relish those obstacles, you know. And those obstacles were not regulatory government things that were put in my way. They were simply monetary obstacles,
yeah,
which I could alleviate by being creative.
And that was it. Listen, our experiences are slightly different, but we went through the same process individually.
Yeah.
My dad was very wealthy.
Right.
My dad had 103 Burger Chef, then Hardee's restaurants. In Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia.
I remember Burger Chef.
Yeah. I had all the advantages. Everyone listening in Kentucky, I know you got a lot of followers in Kentucky. They definitely know what Burger Chef is.
Right.
And, in fact, actually, my grandfather was the second Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise.
Oh, cool.
He started the company my dad bought from him and had it all over, sold all of his stuff to John Y. Brown.
He became my dad did some repair work for Colonel Sanders.
Ah, yeah. Well, so... So my grandfather sold all of his stuff to John Y. Brown, former governor of Kentucky, before he became governor. So those folks will know what we're talking about here. But anyway, my dad had all the financial advantages. I went to an elite private school called the Webb School in Bellbuckle, Tennessee. And it was a fantastic school for me. I really needed it. And, I mean, it cost, I think, $28,000 a year to go there now.
Yeah.
Private high school.
Wow.
And my dad paid for all that. My dad paid for all my college, but I will tell you this. He made me work for all this stuff.
Right.
I mean, he did give me my first car. I didn't get that. I did get that over you. It was a 66 Bel Air. You know, you could one of those that you could open up the hood and,
right.
and see down to the ground around the sides of the engine. And so anyway, but that he didn't like throw all the wonderful stuff at me, but I worked in college.
Right.
I had to support myself for those extra things. But he did that on purpose.
Right.
So that I would also learn these, because he had to do the same thing.
Right. He taught you those lessons in my own way. You know, we always had enough growing up. And I remember wanting my first pair of Nike Airs. And I wanted Air Force Nikes. And they were $47, I think. And I said to my dad, I said, I want to get these Nikes. And he said, you have $20 to buy shoes. That's what I'm providing you.
Yeah.
Now, could he have afforded the Nikes? Yes. But he said, you have $20 to buy the shoes. If you want to buy those, go find a way to make the money to get them. Right. So the same thing as your dad. It's like, yeah, the money was there. I knew the money was there.
Yeah.
But I also knew I wasn't getting it. I was going to get a base amount to be taken care of and wear Walmart zips. Or if I wanted something extra, I had to do that extra thing.
Well, and I would say that we still have parents today. We still have a lot of them that are teaching those values to their kids. We have far less of them than we used to.
Right.
And a lot of people as wealthy as my mom and dad were aren't instilling those values as well because they came up in a generation.
Yeah.
Not entirely. It's not everything. It's just, I see this happening less and less. That's why I think there may potential. That's why I'm concerned, I should say, that there may be some irreparable harm to this culture that we may not be able to get out of because our parents – were informed by the greatest generation.
Right.
You know, the World War II generation.
The next generation of parents is informed by Twitter.
That's right. Oh. And so that concerns me.
Which brings
me,
us back
you know,
to that dehumanizing aspect.
But
that
it really
about.
Is interesting what happens in a culture sometimes.
Yeah.
Because this next generation is going to be more pro-life.
Right.
Than previous generations were.
Right.
We really tanked through the 60s and 70s when it came to a regard for life. These kids grew up with their brothers and sisters' ultrasounds tacked up on the refrigerator.
Right.
There's a different perspective. So there are some positives, some negatives, but I still believe government is so consequential in our lives right now that most people don't even have a concept of what it looks like to not have government be so consequential in your life.
Right.
Even if they read honestly the history, the 18th and 19th century history of this country.
Right.
So I want to see that change. We have to assert it in a political and a cultural way, and we're not doing either. By the way, one of the great disasters for conservatives, I'm using air quotes here, I don't even know what the term conservative means anymore, but of people on the right politically, is they abandoned the fight for the schools from the 1960s on. And we're reaping the rewards of that. That's another area that may have caused irreparable harm to our culture. These are things that concern me because, and again, I come from the Christian perspective, and people will know that listening to this.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I when I think of those issues, I want that benefit for everybody, whether they share my faith in Christ or not.
Right.
That is the promise of this country, is that every person would get those rights.
Right.
There are huge issues in a theological sense that I think we also need to assert in society that would be helpful that not everyone's going to accept. But the one fundamental thing we have to do is secure freedom for everyone. Our Constitution can do that.
Right.
And,
right.
By the way, Thomas always talks about this too. The whole Article 5 convention discussion.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, which I have great respect for Mark Levin. And he still presses this issue, the radio talk show host Mark Levin, who's a great constitutional scholar.
Right.
And he's right, technically. But like Thomas says, and I totally agree with him, he says, like, we can do that to try to fix some things constitutionally. But the problem is, we don't even follow the Constitution we have.
Right.
Why don't we just start there?
Yeah.
That's why I would, even though I'll use the term libertarian to describe my economic and political philosophy, really constitutionalist
is much more
accurate.
Yeah.
If we could just get back there.
Yeah.
But I think it's hard to scrape all that away because of what Thomas, guys like Thomas go through in Washington, D.C. right now.
Crazy stuff. Well, I didn't intend for this conversation to be all about capitalism versus socialism, but I'm glad it was because I think that's the kind of conversations we need to have more of around kitchen tables all over the country. Tell people about your podcast, Against Nice. I've been on it. I loved it. It was a fun experience. We had a blast, and I highly recommend it. You have a lot of really interesting guests, especially if you're interested in diving into the machinations of political stuff and some of these kinds of conversations as well about substantive policy.
Yeah.
You do a great job with that. So tell people how they can get a hold of your podcast.
Well, so www.politicsisntnice.com.
Perfect.
That's my repository. So,
and explain why you called it Against Nice.
Because yeah,
so, I love it. It's a weird name for a podcast, which is good because it grabs your attention. But I love the reason you named it that.
Well, so it kind of originated in my mind back I don't know, maybe 2007 or 8, the concept, at least, when one of these discussions with Andrew Breitbart, you know, he said that he was an agnostic, keep this in mind.
Right.
But he said, and he went to Tulane University, where he became a conservative. And the reason he became a conservative is this Catholic university, all these Christians started treating this Jewish guy really, really well. Mm-hmm. They respected him. They were interested in him, helpful to him. So he said, you know, I love Christians because the Judeo-Christian ethic is where the ideas and concepts of liberty come from.
Right.
He said, but Christians are way too nice. So he said, and he was a pretty bombastic guy. He says, I feel like part of my job is to protect Christians because they won't fight for themselves.
Right.
So I got he says they're too nice. So I got thinking about this. Is that true? So when you take a look at the definition of the word nice, it's really a subjective criteria.
Right.
Anything that's pleasing and acceptable to me, that's basically what I consider nice.
Right.
Whereas there's a concept of kindness, a biblical concept of kindness, in fact, that looks to the benefits of others. Micah 6:8 says, God has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. And that word for kindness is really almost untranslatable from the Hebrew. It's the loving kindness of God.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thoughtfulness towards others. So I started thinking about this after that. And for some years, I intended to write a book. So I'm talking to Peter Schweitzer a couple years ago. He's a really close friend of mine, the guy that did Clinton Cash and Secret Empires and revealed the Biden problems. So, I mean, that was a Peter Schweitzer thing.
Right.
Peter's a really good friend of mine. And so I was telling him, you know, I want to write this book. And I said, but, you know, as I think about it more, you have to be able to market yourself. I said, so I'm thinking I ought to do a podcast about that. And he was like, oh, yeah, you absolutely should. He was the first interview that I had on there. But I want to get not just people of religious faith, but all people to understand that the value of being nice is an invalid one.
Right.
Scripturally, there's no command to be nice at all.
Right.
And in fact, when you look at Jesus, you know, he never harmed the broken
kind.
Reed.
He wasn't nice.
Right.
He was kind.
Right. He never harmed the broken reed, those who were harmed by life, to the extent that he was accused of hanging out with sinners and prostitutes, right?
Right.
The people that were harmed by life, he was concerned with. But the religious leaders and the political leaders at the time, he called out, called the Pharisees a brood of vipers.
Yes.
There is a place for harsh correction or even mild correction.
Right.
No one would consider a parent that didn't discipline their children in some form or fashion to be very kind. But no child being disciplined thinks it's very nice.
Right.
You know, we got a lot of people that don't like being disciplined, whether it's naturally by life or directly by others. And so I think that I'm trying to find ways to change that attitude. And so I don't want to tell people to be mean and nasty, but people have got to have courage and fortitude.
Yeah.
We lack that in this political debate. And normal folks, and I say normal because they're the real people that aren't constantly involved in politics, still need to be aware of what's going on in politics. And they need to go in with courage and fortitude based on principles.
Yep.
And that's what I'm trying to do.
What platforms can people find your podcast on?
Well, on the website, www.politicsisn'tnice.com. Just to repeat that. Also, Against Nice on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And then facebook.com/AgainstNice. I'm there. Other social media. But those are the main ones that I'm engaged
with. Fantastic. Well, it's good seeing you, man.
Yeah, you too.
I enjoyed this.
Appreciate your friendship. And,
yeah, you as well.
And you do a fantastic job. I listen to yours to figure out what I ought to do.
I think we all work together in that sense. So.
That's right.
Awesome. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
That was a great conversation, a blast. Thank you all for listening. Thanks again to Louisville Cabinets and Countertops for their sponsorship of this program. Again, check them out at LouisvilleCabinetsandCountertops.com. You can literally do anything with them from a full complete kitchen reno, like turnkey, like you just say, here's what I want done, walk away, they do it, to if you're a do-it-yourselfer or a contractor, you can pick up cabinets and countertops in the store. They've got cabinets in stock. They've got laminate countertops that can sometimes cut the same day, but if you're looking for granite or quartz or stone, they've got anything you're looking for at Louisville Cabinets and Countertops. 6200 Hit Lane, right on the border of Louisville and Odom County. So if you're in Louisville or Odom County or Southern Indiana, these are your guys. They did our kitchen, and I stand behind their work. They're absolutely awesome. So if you're looking to remodel your kitchen, make it your dream home,
call these guys and tell them Leland Conway sent you. It would be very greatly appreciated. So also thanks to Dynamics Audio and their production help with the program, as well as JP Web Design in Lexington. And you can find us on Twitter. It's at Leland Show or at Zone Disruption. You can also find us on Instagram at Great Lelando and at The Disruption Zone. And you can also download the podcast anywhere podcasts are found. Google Podcasts or Google Play, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and have it delivered directly to your pocket when new episodes come out. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.